Tuesday evening, modern-day followers of two of the 20th century's greatest economists came together at the London School of Economics to debate the ideas of their intellectual heroes. Newsnight's economics editor, Paul Mason, is your chair.
Good evening. I'm Paul Mason, and welcome to the Old Theatre at the London School of Economics, where, with a packed audience and a panel of distinguished economic thinkers, we're going to thrash out an argument so critical to economics that it's inspired not one, but two rap songs. The question is, who was right? Indeed, who is right? Friedrich August von Hayek or John Maynard Keynes? Keynes and Hayek both had a close association with this place, the LSE. Hayek taught here from the 30s to 1950. Hayek and Keynes were giants of 20th century economics, with very different ideas about how depressed economies climb out of recession. The positions roughly summarised free market economics versus state intervention, although, as I can hear the teeth of various academics gnashing, it is a lot more complex than that. So tonight, we're going to ask whose theories have a chance of digging the West out of the economic hole we're in. Our debaters, well, I'm going to let them give a one-line introduction to themselves. Robert Skidelsky.
I'm Keynes's biographer, Professor of Political Economy at the University of Warwick.
George Selgin.
I'm a monetary economist at the University of Georgia in the United States.
Duncan Weldon.
I'm an economist and an economic blogger.
And Jamie White.
I'm a former philosopher and management consultant.
Now, the aim is to keep the high intellectual tone appropriate to the LSE. So we're going to begin as follows. If you count yourself a Keynesian, would you please shout, Yo Keynes?
Yo Keynes!
If you count yourself a follower of Hayek, would you please shout, Yo Hayek?
Yo Hayek!
And if you believe both theories to be trapped in an outmoded marginalist paradigm that should have ended with the 20th century, please go, Yo Neither. Right. Let's see how it goes. Now, if you want to tweet about this, the hashtag is #LSEHVK. Now, first up, to speak for 4 minutes, Lord Skidelsky, Keynes biographer, crossbench peer, emeritus professor of political economy at Warwick.
The latest figures from the Office of National Statistics show that the British economy is flat on its back. Now, that wouldn't have surprised Keynes. He wrote The General Theory in 1936 to explain the Great Depression of 1929 to 1932. And he put forward a revolutionary theory. There were no automatic forces in an economy, in market economy, to produce a recovery. The economy would go on shrinking until it reached a low level of stability, and Keynes called this position underemployment equilibrium. The economy would then stay stuck there until something happened to revive the animal spirits of businessmen. Now, Keynes and Hayek never debated their differences at a meeting like today's, but in 1931, Hayek came to Cambridge to explain his theory to an audience of young economists. He impressed on them that the only way to recovery was for everyone to save more. And one of them got up. Professor Hayek, is it your view that if I went out tomorrow and bought a new overcoat, that would increase unemployment? Yes, replied Hayek, turning to a blackboard which he had filled with triangles. But it would take a very long mathematical argument to explain why. Contrast this with Keynes. Whenever you save 5 shillings, you put a man out of work. Well, I submit, here we are today. We're in a position of underemployment equilibrium. There's no growth, and only George Osborne to revive our animal spirits. Now, Keynes said in that situation, a government needed to run a deficit to whatever extent necessary to offset the decline in private spending. To cut government spending in a slump was exactly the wrong policy. It wouldn't produce growth, only prolong stagnation. Keynes's message was, you can't cut yourself out of a slump, you've got to grow yourself out of a slump. Unless there's growth, the government won't even be able to meet its own deficit targets. Well, it was Friedrich von Hayek who upheld the orthodox theory which Keynes was attacking. Hayek said that the main causes of slumps was excessive credit creation by the banks, which led to overinvestment. The boom was the illusion. The slump was the reality. So the slump must be allowed to run its course till the bad investments had been liquidated. The American Secretary of the Treasury, Andrew Mellon, a millionaire, by the way, was a great liquidator. Mr. Mellon had only one formula, wrote his boss, Herbert Hoover. Liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, liquidate the farmer, liquidate real estate. It will purge the rottenness out of the system. People will work harder, lead a more moral life. Well, that's roughly what Hayek was advocating in 1929, 1930. He may have changed his mind a bit later, but you know, it's what you say at the moment when it counts that defines you. And to say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that really, I changed my mind, is not a very good advertisement for his thinking. Now, Hayek's liquidation policies were faithfully followed by the German Chancellor Heinrich Brüning and brought Hitler to power. Hayek later wrote a famous book, The Road to Serfdom, claiming that Hitler's rise had nothing to do with the slump and certainly nothing to do with his advice. In the United States, Roosevelt became president with the American recovery at a standstill and started the New Deal. Worsted in his battle with Keynes, Hayek gave up serious economics, though not serious writing. He and Keynes developed a wary respect and even liking for each other. We get on very well in private life, Keynes said, but what rubbish his theory is. Keynes' magnetism made a deep impression on Hayek, but he never stopped believing that Keynes' influence on economics had been tragic. So I've put the argument, who would you prefer to be in charge of our economic life today, Keynes or Hayek?
To respond to that, I'm pleased to introduce Jamie White, former philosophy lecturer at Cambridge University, now head of research at the management consultancy Oliver Wyman. 4 minutes, please.
The power of prayer is something people are normally inclined to doubt. But in moments of peril, credulity increases, and the idea of a magical benefactor becomes irresistible. As the saying goes, there are no atheists in trenches. Or to adapt it to economics, there are no Hayekians in recessions. No one wants to suffer the pain of liquidating bad investments, including the bad investment of working for the wrong firm. During a recession, the Keynesian idea that government spending can save us becomes irresistible. Hence, the return of the master, as Lord Skidelsky puts it in the title of his recent book. Since Keynesian policies were last popular and unsuccessful in the 1970s, the growing consensus had been that paying people to dig holes in the ground and dropping freshly printed dollar notes from helicopters are not paths to prosperity. But it does not take long for the desperate to forget 1,000 unanswered prayers. When the Federal Reserve's price-fixing and interest rates finally led to a financial crisis in 2008, politicians around the world recommitted their lives to Keynes. That's not quite right. Politicians around the world committed the lives of citizens to government officials. The central idea of Keynesianism is that because ordinary people are subject to irrational mood swings, politicians and their appointed bureaucrats, who are cleverer and less animal in their spirits, should force us to make the correct investment decisions. In your irrational fear, you may be unwilling to invest in a failed bank, or in a company that builds green cars, or that makes tunnels allowing turtles to cross the road in Florida. You may be unwilling to invest in a firm that buys cars just for the purpose of smashing them. Well, then, government officials will make you invest in them by borrowing the money, investing in those enterprises, and, on threat of imprisonment, making you service the debt through your taxes. Submit to these superior people, and you'll be saved. You may think the talk of prayer, submission, and salvation is unfair. Keynesian economics is not a religion, but a science. When Christina Romer, President Obama's advisor, designed the stimulus package for him, she did so with mathematical precision. Borrowing hundreds of billions to spend on turtle tunnels and the like, she told us, would have a multiplier effect of 1.57. For every dollar of government spending, GDP would increase by $1.57. Not $1.56, $1.57. This is science. Unfortunately, in the same report, we learned that Ms. Romer's Keynesian model predicted US unemployment peaking at 9% without her stimulus and at 8% with it. Well, we got the stimulus and unemployment peaked at 10%. The Keynesian model didn't just get the magnitude of the effect wrong, it got the direction of the effect wrong. as it did during the Great Depression, the Keynesian policies followed by the Hoover and Roosevelt administrations, which were supposed to shorten the length of the downturn, caused it to be the longest in known history. The problem with Keynesian economics is not that it is unscientific. Like any good scientific theory, it issues testable predictions. The problem is that it is false. Macroeconomics is a difficult and relatively new subject. Even theories that have not yet experienced repeated empirical refutation, such as Keynesianism, should inspire skepticism. To discard voluntary exchange and the normal consequences of business failure in return for the promised benefits of some miraculous macroeconomic theory is intellectually adolescent. Someone who does it is like a teenager who, having read a New Age self-help book, comes to his parents and tells them that all their inherited wisdom is bunkum. Alas, unlike teenagers, the wishful politicians who adopt Keynesian economic policy are not just hormones and big talk. They're hormones and big government. The Keynesian delusion encourages politicians to wield the power of the state in ways that do enormous harm.
Okay, let me probe that for a minute. Lord Skidelsky, is Keynesianism not simply the intellectual byproduct of the fact that capitalism moved in a state direction in the mid-century? I mean, what's special about the work of the man himself?
Well, at the time, and Jamie White's speech typifies this, there was the economics profession did not believe in state intervention in the working of the economy. They thought the government should stay clear. And the economies became extremely volatile, as has been shown just very recently. And these big fluctuations were not something that economic theories explain. And Keynes said that you cannot suffer them. Governments ought to do something about them, because otherwise there would be too much pain.
George Selgin, as one of the defenders of Hayek, Hayek is often characterized as a do-nothing theorist, liquidate everything. Was Hayek, in this sense, a liquidator? Was he a do-nothing economist?
Well, he was a liquidator, but he wasn't a do-nothing economist. Now, Hayek wasn't an inflationist because he didn't want to start another boom, but he was neither someone who said, let spending collapse, it doesn't matter, or it's a good thing. Not after the actual collapse came.
That wasn't what he said in 1931 and not what he said in the debates in 1932. The fact that Hayek managed to accept this by 1935, a great achievement. Just printing a lot of money doesn't actually make sure that anyone spends it. It can be hoarded. And then you can go on printing and printing and printing. The genius of the Keynesian solution was it was a way of getting money spent when people were hoarding it. That's the whole point.
George Selgin, I see you are delving into your notes.
I'm chafing at the bit. Keynes didn't worry about booms. He had nothing to say about booms. Animal spirits are on, then they're off. That's the theory. And this was neglecting the fact that excessive money creation is no more neutral than deficient money creation. Hayek was consistent. He was symmetrical. Keynes was not. He was purely a theorist of the bust.
George, would he have supported quantitative easing? Would he have supported printing money?
In principle, he would have. He didn't have any faith in central banks' ability to get it right, but he let me read a passage from Saving, 1933. Unless the banks create additional credits for investment purposes to the same extent that holders of deposits have ceased to use them for current expenditure, the effect is the same as that of hoarding currency, and with all the undesirable deflationary consequences attaching to that, that's about as clear as you can get about stabilizing spending.
Duncan Weldon, I just want to bring you in here for a second, just to bring it slightly up to date. The idea behind Keynesianism is that, look, during the boom, the government wears a hair shirt, but during the recession, the government intervenes. You were quite close to the centres of power, towards the latter end of the Labour government. Where was the hair shirt?
Well, I mean, this is often something people say about Keynesian. They say, you know, governments want to be very Keynesian during a downturn, nobody wants to be Keynesian during an upturn, and it's very, very hard for politicians. What I would point out is in 2001, the last time the UK government was running a surplus, the Conservatives under William Hague attacked them for running a surplus, saying they were hoarding taxpayers' money and should be cutting taxes. It's very, very hard for a government to run a surplus. But the thing is, the public finances were not in an ideal state in 2007, but not in a disastrous state. The actual stock of outstanding debt was low by international standards. I would also say this. say rather than running a small but still a structural deficit in 2007, the UK government had been running a small surplus, and nobody's saying they should have been running a huge surplus. What would our deficit be now? Okay, maybe rather than being 10% of GDP, it would be 8% of GDP. It wouldn't make a huge difference.
Okay, I'm going to open this to the floor. I'm wondering slightly, I can see where all the Hayekians are camped on this balcony, what you all think of George's revelation, in fact, of Hayek as a monetary stimulus proponent. But
stabilisation.
Okay, stabilisation but printing money. To you, sir.
Hello, my name's Gordon Kerr of the Cobden Centre. Duncan made the point that our national debt was relatively low in 2007, and then, of course, we had the biggest economic stimulus of recent decades, the bailout of the banks. Seems to me to have been an economic disaster, saddling the next generation and ourselves with unimaginable and unrepayable levels of debt. Am I wrong?
I'd make 2 points on that. The first one was, well, 3 points, in fact. Yes, we took on a lot of debt when we took over, essentially, RBS and Lloyds TSB. We assumed their liabilities. We also, though, assumed their assets. And I often find it very strange that we always talk about government debt, but don't look at the asset side of the government's balance sheet. The second point I'd make is, if we hadn't done that, if we'd actually allowed RBS and Lloyds TSB to fail, I think that would have been an absolute catastrophe for the UK economy. Literally, cash machines would have stopped working. This could have been a far more severe economic blow than we had. Finally, I'd say, though, yes, I think the way we've taken over RBS and Lloyds TSB and then just sat on them and not changed anything else isn't ideal. I think printing £200 billion and not ensuring it got into the real economy was not a good idea. I think Keynes would have been more inventive. I think Keynes might have said, let's print the money and give it to a national investment corporation.
Fortunately, we have one of the key figures of the free banking school here to explain what they might have done. George, do you want to just chip in here? About?
Well, I hate to anticipate my speech. But let's not forget, Keynes argued it doesn't matter how you put the money into the economy. You can build pyramids with it. You could dig holes in the ground and have people fill them again. You can fill bottles of with banknotes and bury them here and there. That kind of argument lends itself to the assumption that it's also okay to give the money to insolvent banks where it sits. That is as much a consequence of the Keynesian emphasis that spending alone, any spending, can get you out of trouble as it is of anything else.
Not wrong.
Well, pyramid
wrong.
Building?
Wrong.
Giving it to the RBS? What's the difference?
Keynes said you dig up holes and fill them up again if you can't think of anything better to do.
Well, that's apparently the government wasn't able to come up with anything better than giving it to the banks.
Gentlemen, right at the back, please.
Hi, my name is Shiv Malik. I'm the co-author of Jilted Generation. Economics is essentially still a moral science, and underlying these two great economists are the values of freedom for Hayek, let's say, and security for Keynes. Could you speak to whether that is, you would say that's correct, and then ultimately whether a sort of a new generation today has effectively sort of, you know, wants both and therefore needs a new kind of economy?
Jimmy White.
I think the Hayekian position doesn't need to be based on a love of liberty, though most Hayekians do love liberty. In fact, the good utilitarian arguments for it. So if you have a rule of law-based system, a kind of market system, the idea is that over the long run, people are better off. Also, wonderfully, they're free. The two things go together. There's not a conflict. Under the state interventionist system, you get a perpetual erosion of liberty and a sclerosis in the economy, and people are both less free and worse off.
Robert Skidelsky.
Yeah, and I don't think there's a real conflict between freedom and security. I mean, one of the things Keynes said, and I think you look back to the 30s and you realise how important it was, and I think you can see some of it today, that without security, freedom is in danger. If, in fact, you inflict too much pain on economies, cause too much unemployment to develop, don't do things about it, you start getting a lot of social discontent. And I think he thought, and he had this very interesting exchange with Hayek in 1944, a very friendly exchange, and he said, look, we both want to protect freedom, we just disagree about how we should do it, because I think the effect of your policies will be to endanger freedom, and I think the effect of my policies will be to support freedom. And in fact, the liberal capitalist economy revived after the Second World War under really a Keynesian umbrella.
I'm Paul Mason, and you're listening to the Hayek versus Keynes debate at the London School of Economics on BBC Radio 4. Now, in 2008, the global financial system stood on the brink of collapse. Alan Greenspan, the former Federal Reserve boss, said he'd found a flaw in free market theory. A flurry of Keynesian intervention followed. Fiscal stimulus, monetary stimulus, competitive devaluation in some places, capital controls. And it worked. In China. But not in the West. Instead of bankrupting the banks, we decided to bankrupt states. So the euro is in crisis, America stands on the brink of a technical default, growth in the United Kingdom is flatlining. Who can save us, Hayek or Keynes? Now, to answer this, I'm delighted to call on George Selgin, Professor of Economics at the Terry School of Business, University of Georgia.
Thank you very much. So, the real difference between Hayek and Keynes is that Hayek saw a connection between depressions and booms that Keynes refused to acknowledge. For Hayek, booms involve unsustainable investment encouraged by easy monetary policies that is bound ultimately to lead to a bust, maybe a serious one, maybe not so serious. Thanks in part to easy money, the world economy is now experiencing a very bad malinvestment hangover after a wild subprime lending party. The Hayekians warned against the party, and now they're being blamed for stating that there's no painless way to avoid the hangover. Spending alone won't cure it, because the economy isn't just suffering from a lack of spending. It's suffering from having made huge, unsustainable investments in the housing and financial services industry. When the bust came, a lot of construction workers who had been building houses during the boom lost their jobs. No one's happy about this, of course. But we have to accept that those people cannot go back to jobs building houses at a time when we're bulldozing the houses we already built. The story in the financial industry looks better, but is actually a lot worse. It looks better in the sense that many bankers are still doing just fine. I can tell from all the Aston Martins and Maseratis around my hotel in Kensington. But the fact is, the financial industry hasn't retrenched in the way the construction industry has. It's more bloated than ever, in fact, to judge from the actual statistics, yet it's not adding value to the world economy, nor is it doing its part to help other businesses to do so. The straightforward recipe for a revival of healthy investment following the 2008 crisis was to liquidate Bear Stearns, liquidate Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Liquidate, in short, the whole subprime bubble-blowing apparatus that was nurtured by easy monetary policy. And yes, that would have meant letting insolvent banks that lent or invested unwisely go bust. Instead, our governments have chose to keep bad banks going, and that is why quantitative easing has proven a failure. It isn't just that spending hasn't recovered. In fact, consumer spending has pretty much gotten back to its pre-crisis level. Take my word for it, this is accurate. Anyway, the problem is a lack of productive investment. Quantitative easing failed because almost all the new money the Fed created, starting with the money it used to buy vast amounts of subprime securities at the beginning of the crisis, has gone to shore up the balance sheets of irresponsible bankers. Now those banks sit on piles of idle cash while other businesses starve or can't get started for want of credit. Now, Keynesians call this situation a liquidity trap and claim that the answer is more government spending. But this particular liquidity trap is one Keynesian ideas helped set, because Keynesians support indiscriminate spending, but to defend indiscriminate spending is to defend indiscriminate bailouts. The government did worse than build pyramids. It used new money to prop up insolvent banks, which are now so many giant liquidity sponges. Yet there are people with small businesses who can't borrow. The economy is like a drunk throwing up the morning after the night before. It's disgorging itself, or trying to disgorge itself, of bad investments it was tempted to undertake only because of excessively bad easy money, or largely because of it. Giving it still more money won't prevent the inevitable suffering. It might mask or delay it somewhat, but only at the cost of more suffering later. This isn't the sort of advice governments welcome. They want a painless, easy way like the one Keynesians offer. But as Hayekians warned again and again, there's no painless recovery from an unsustainable boom. The only way to have no pain is to avoid the boom itself.
To respond to that, Duncan Weldon, an advisor to an international trade union federation.
Britain, to a large extent, has voluntarily embarked on the toughest course of government spending cuts for decades. I say voluntary because this was a choice. Yes, Britain was running a very large deficit, but the markets were still lending to Britain at 3.5%, near historic lows for 10-year government bonds. The existing stock of British government debt was low by international standards, and British government debt has the longest maturity in the developed world. Our average debt is 14 years away from being paid off. Yes, the deficit has to be brought down, but the markets were not screaming out for it to be eliminated at such a rapid pace. 1 year ago, the UK government policy turned more Hayekian, and the early indications are it's not working. In the last 9 months, the economy, hit by collapsing confidence, a VAT rise, and the beginnings, just the beginnings of austerity, has grown by 0.2%. In the 9 months before that, when we still had in place a broadly Keynesian stimulatory policy, the economy grew by 2.1%. 2.1% versus 0.2%. That's quite a difference. The government are now telling us that their rapid deficit reduction has returned stability to the economy. That's actually pretty fair, if you think about it. 9 months of stagnation is pretty stable. In late 2008, the centre of the world's financial system took a near-fatal shock. Demand evaporated, and world trade shrunk at a quicker pace than at the onset of the Great Depression. Governments around the world responded with a Keynesian stimulus package. 2.5 years later, collapse has been avoided. Where are we now, then? The recovery in Britain, which has led the way in terms of austerity amongst the major economies, is anemic. The US is moving, via what looks to be a high-stakes game of budgetary chicken, towards austerity of its own. Austerity is already being pushed to its limits in the southern bit of the Eurozone, and is also there in the north. We have near simultaneous global cuts in government spending, the most since 1981, according to the IMF. As Ken said, you will never balance the budget through measures which reduce the national income. Think about where we are in Britain at the moment. The consumer is over-indebted and not spending. Our export prospects look pretty bleak. Remember, our largest trading partner is the Eurozone, which has its own problems at the moment. And businesses are not investing. If government spending starts to be cut back, where is the demand going to come from? I'd end by saying, Keynes once wrote that one day he hoped economists would be regarded like dentists. That is to say, humble and competent people whom you went to see when you had a problem requiring help. So I ask you this. If you had a case of toothache, which of these dentist economists would you rather go and see? Dr. Keynes, who would try and find you a solution, or Dr. Hayek, who would say, well, you shouldn't have got toothache in the first place. Don't worry about it. Eventually the rotten teeth will fall out all by themselves.
Jamie White.
There's a mischaracterisation of what's going on in Britain at the moment. I mean, the cuts are minute. Once you've got the welfare state in place, you get an automatic expansion of government spending during a downturn. And we are also digging holes in the ground in Afghanistan and Libya. We have bailed out the banks. It's all pretty Keynesian, actually. It's just not as much as Keynesians would like. And what the Keynesians always argue is that if it's not working, it's only because they haven't done enough. And in fact, what little they have done has saved us from catastrophe. If they hadn't done it all, things would have been so much worse.
Lord Skidelsky.
The Hayekians are sort of, they live in a dream world of their own. Tiny, tiny cuts. $32 billion a year for 5 years out of the economy. Tiny cuts. Reallocation of resources. These are just phrases. What does it mean in terms of human lives? It's sort of so abstract and unreal. You know, Hayekians aren't exactly thick on the ground. They may be here, I applaud their eagerness to come and hear the Keynesian case. But on the whole, they have no influence on policy, and most people don't actually think that they've got anything to contribute. I mean, it's one thing saying, all right, you shouldn't have a boom, and I accept all that, such a boom, you have to regulate the banking system. But once you're there, once you're in this hole, what does Hayek have to offer? What does he have to offer us?
Well, George.
Well, the answer is, first of all, that what Hayek has to offer is advice right now. Don't start another one. In 2001, following the dot-com boom, let's not forget that, right, the Federal Reserve decided it was going to help the economy recover by holding down interest rates. And the Hayekians consistently warned of the dangers of that. Those who say Hayek has nothing to offer are very short-sighted. They want you to not listen to him now so that they can say, well, he has nothing to offer next time we have a crash. This is not good advice. It's as if you were warned by someone not to go on a drinking binge, and then you did it anyway, and then you got sick, and then this person said, well, you know, you knew this was coming. He said, don't give me that. Give me some real advice I can use.
So you warn someone not to go on a drinking binge. He doesn't take your advice. He falls into the gutter, he starts shivering, and you let him stay there.
Not so.
That's what you do.
The advice is to maintain the flow of spending, to offset declines in velocity with corresponding advances in the quantity of money. That is the advice.
Those are words.
Well, sir, that's all economists have.
What about actions? What about
Hayek
actions?
Hayek couldn't walk into the Bank of England or the Fed and take over. He could only say, in theory, what should be done.
Well, what is the Keynesian answer to no? Bearing in mind we had the bank bailout, a lot of people think it created moral hazard. We have money printing on both sides of the Atlantic. In the American case, huge stimulus, not particularly stimulating the economy. What more would a true Keynesian do?
Well, I would set up, and I think Keynes supported something like this in 1933, I would set up a national investment bank, and I would. We already have an institution that could be enlarged to fill that purpose, which is a green bank, which has got a capital of $3 billion, but it's not allowed to borrow, and it hasn't started. I would make it a much bigger bank, and I would allow it to borrow frozen savings that now have no use and aren't being lent to businesses.
George Selzer.
Well, let's see, we had some government-sponsored lending institutions in the United States, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They had charge of a lot of money during the first decade of the 2000s, and guess where they put it all? In the mortgage and subprime mortgage market. I don't think governments can be trusted to do better than the market. They can only be kept from doing bad things. As for fiscal expansion, look, there's been no episode of a depression that was cured by fiscal expansion. And the U.S., as has been conceded, had no austerity program. It might have one soon. We've spent all kinds of money, huge bundles of money, and we have had less recovery than most other countries and the most post-boom unemployment.
I'm now going to take another quick fire round of questions from the audience. Madam.
Okay. My name is Lovely de Guzman. It really is lovely. my question is, what would Hayek and Keynes have done with the euro crisis? And specifically towards George, would Hayek have done a sort of two-tier euro or more of a privatized euro?
As if I didn't have enough work on my hands. Well, Hayek was no fan of the euro. If anything, he was a fan of the idea of a hard euro or hard ECU that would add to the menu of choices among Europeans by preserving the existing currencies and introducing one more option, just in case. And I think Hayek's being vindicated. I think that right now a lot of people would be better off if there'd still been a German mark and they could switch to it.
Duncan Weldon.
I'd say to start with, this is, you know, if we look at what happened in Southern Europe in the 10 years before the crash, when the ECB did set interest rates very low, there is your classic Hayekian boom. You know, well done to Hayek, he spots that. But now we're in the crash, again, is it Keynes or is it Hayek? What we've seen is an extreme adoption of austerity in coming into Portugal, now coming into Spain, certainly in Greece, in Ireland. And what's happened? We've had emergency budgets cutting spending, the economy shrunk further, the deficits have got bigger, and what's been the answer? We'll try again.
Lady here, please.
Sybil Gillespie, sixth form student. This is for George Selgin, but others as well. You spoke of supporting the bad banks, as you call them, but considering the effect of the collapse of Lehman's on the global financial system and the economy, what would you do if not prop up the banks which are failing if this happened again in the future?
Well, I think it's a myth that it was the collapse of Lehman's that caused what had been a financial crisis only to become a general economic crisis. There have been quite a few studies looking into the timing of the collapse of spending and particularly of the seizing up, as they called it, of the interbank or wholesale lending markets. And it appears that that's coincided not with the failure of Lehman Brothers, but with the Fed's implementation of its policy. It's ridiculous policy, I think we'll all agree, of paying banks to not lend money. It was on the day that that policy took effect that the wholesale lending market in the United States seized up. It wasn't worth banks' effort to lend to other banks liquidity when they could get interest just by holding on to it themselves.
Duncan Weldon, let me just throw that back at you because it's a persistent thing this audience is raising and the public. Okay, we may have had to bail out some of the banks, but as a result, there's zombie capital, basically, in the banks, in many businesses, among many families. We're just not prepared to take that final moment of crisis resolution and write stuff off. What do the Keynesians say about that?
Since Keynes' death, economists such as Minsky, who people ignored and now really coming back to since the crash, or recently people like Richard Koo, who've pointed out you get these huge build-ups of debt in economies. And I'm not talking about public sector debts, I'm talking about debt at the corporate level, debt at the household level, debt in the financial system. And things stop working when people are just trying to pay down debt. If your entire private sector is trying to deleverage, trying to pay down debt, government has to spend. Otherwise, no one does. And we get in a negative feedback cycle of everything going down.
But there are healthy banks. There are healthy banks. And those banks are the banks that ought to be getting money and would be getting it if the other banks were wound up. People would take the money away from Citibank and all these other zombies, and they would put it in banks that would put it to work in the economy.
I will just point out that Citibank itself, Citigroup, its parent company, may disagree that it itself is a zombie. I'll take my final question. Sir, at the top there, please.
Hello, my name is Rory Meakin. I'm from the Taxpayers Alliance. While recent growth figures have been rather flat, the latest OBR figures show George Osborne's government has been ejaculating 4.9% more stimulus into the economy this June than June last year. Is it time for cuts?
Duncan.
It's always nice to get a question from the Taxpayers Alliance. Some of my favourite prayers on my blog comes from the Taxpayers Alliance. I'm intellectually dishonest, a hack, and know very little about economics, so bear with me if I stumble a bit here. It's interesting. It's very interesting. In the last quarter, government borrowing isn't coming down. Despite a VAT rise, despite £6 billion of spending cuts last year, and more spending cuts starting now, borrowing is not coming down. This is the Keynes quote I mentioned before. You cannot reduce the government deficit through measures which reduce the national income. The Chancellor is chasing his own tail. Every time he's cutting, he's driving down growth. That puts more people out of work, takes down the tax take. It's a self-defeating strategy, as Ireland and Greece have discovered over the last 3 years.
Absolutely right, but yeah.
If it were true...
Jamie White. But
your argument simply assumes that government spending does increase growth, and the record doesn't show that to be true. I mean, the Keynesians' position has been tried many times and it doesn't work. That's why this argument is so strange. The market mechanism, it's understood how free exchange leads to the correct allocation of resources. You're willing to throw that away on the basis of a fantasy that government spending works when it's been shown repeatedly that it does not.
Here's the point. Spending has recovered much of what it lost. Investments hasn't. Now, Here's the thing. It's a fallacy that spending on government programs is the same as building factories and new businesses and so on. The kind of growth that gets you out of a deficit is not what government spending brings.
Yeah, that's wrong. Just a very, very brief point. Government spending keeps up demand in the economy. People invest when they see orders coming through. Insofar as government spending keeps up demand, it encourages investment. Government doesn't have to invest things invest itself.
Robert, that may be true in theory.
No, it's true in practice.
But what about America? On my travels through America, I don't see much of the fiscal stimulus filtering through into either investment or spending. It's not very efficient as a country to spend the money.
The counterfactual is, what would have happened without it?
These guys think it could have recovered.
These guys think that Roosevelt caused the American slump to be a lot deeper than it would have been.
Yes, I will emphatically defend it in detail. Lord Skidelsky will give me 2 minutes to do so.
If good Hayekian remedies had been adopted, America would have absolutely bounced back after a little bit from the greatest slump in world history.
Right.
If you believe that, you are really living in a cuckoo cloud world.
Before we wind up, if John Maynard Keynes could be reincarnated for us in this room for 10 seconds only, what would he be saying to President Obama?
He would be saying, set up a national infrastructure bank to get investment going in the United States. That's what he'd be saying now.
George Selgin, if Friedrich August Hayek could be reincarnated right in front of us, what advice would he give to David Cameron?
His advice would be that if you keep relying on central banks to get monetary conditions right, you're going to keep having boom-bust cycles, and you're going to have to think about ways to ultimately dispense with central banks if you want to avoid these kinds of crises.
Or, in other words, Mervyn King should maybe stay at the cricket. Ladies and gentlemen, we're nearing the end of the programme. Keynes' famous last words were, I think, I should have drunk more champagne. I can't offer you any, but the bars around the LSE will surely reverberate for the rest of the evening with continued argument and disagreement. For now, we'll close by taking a vote in the manner we started. In answer to which of these two great economists was right and which has answers for today, beginning with Keynes, give me your response. Well, he who shouts loudest shouts last, I think, from there. I think the Hayekians slightly have it. It just remains for me to say thank you to Lord Skidelsky, George Selgin, Jamie White and Duncan Weldon. From me, Paul Mason at the London School of Economics, thank you and good night.
The Keynes versus Hayek debate was produced by Daniel Tetlow.